Hello, welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ojachowski, and I am co-hosting today with Lauren.
Yay!
Hi, Lauren.
Hi, you set up this interview, so I wanted to make sure that you would have the opportunity in your transition to taking over the show.
My transition to power.
Your transition to power, that you have an opportunity to do some co-hosting.
Well, thank you, Lauren. I'm really, really excited about today's show. Today we're speaking with Will Potter. Will is a blogger. He is a freelance journalist. He's an excellent writer, and he writes about all sorts of issues. Specifically, though, we're talking to him today about the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act. We're going to talk about animal rights activism in the context of civil liberties and what all this means for activists such as ourselves and such as yourselves.
Yourselves. I should say, too, that he's an award-winning journalist.
He is.
He's a decorated journalist.
He's a decorated journalist. If they gave out decorations for journalism, he would have some pinned to his lapel.
I wanted to let people know, too, if you want to write us ideas for upcoming shows or any feedback about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Again, that's animalvoices, all one word, @gmail.com. And, of course, our website is animalvoices.ca, and you can check out this program in about a week or two online as a podcast. And I think we have now 271 programs that are available for free download. And, of course, we do have a Facebook group as well. Just go to facebook.com and key in Animal Voices and become our friend.
Become our friend.
We'd love to befriend you.
But before we befriend you, let's bring you some news, shall we? Okay. So the first piece of news is coming to us from ARC2, the local AR group here in Toronto. They say, "Dear activist, breaking news. After 8 months of our campaign to stop the sale of shark cartilage, ARC2, along with other animal rights and animal conservation groups, have received word from one of our targets, Holista Health Canada Incorporated." This is what Holista writes. "Holista has ceased purchasing shark cartilage raw materials and will no longer be producing shark cartilage products. It is our hope that the decision will contribute to the necessary global moratorium required on the harvesting of sharks." That's the end of their quote. "We wish to thank everyone who has been persistent with us in calling and writing Holista to encourage and influence this important decision. Please take a moment to send a thank you letter to Holista for leading the way to the necessary global moratorium on shark products. You can call or write to Holista Health Canada Incorporated. They're at 2000 Brigantine Drive, Coquitlam, BC. V as in Victor, 3, K as in Kite, 7, B as in Bob, 5. You can call them toll-free by telephone 1-800-204-4372, or you can email them at info@holista.ca. That's info@holista.ca. Please do send along a word of support to them for stopping selling and producing products with shark cartilage. And if you want more information about that campaign, it's an ongoing campaign. Please do check out www.ark-ii.com. And big kudos to ARC2 for getting that done and passing that news along to us. The second announcement for today is coming to us from Panacea. Ken wanted us to pass along a few little specials that may interest some people in coming into the store. On special from May 4th to 10th, he's selling clean canteens, BPA-free, food-grade, stainless.
I just wanted to mention, for people who don't know what Panacea
right.
is, it's an environmentally friendly and animal-friendly store, and all of the products in it are free of animal products. So if you go in and you're vegan, you don't have to read the label, which is a really bizarre and fun experience. And so Ken has this three-pronged approach to purchasing. When he gets products in, he wants to make sure that they're socially conscious, so they're not produced in a sweatshop. He wants to make sure that they're low impact and environmentally conscious. And then, of course, an eye towards making the products as cruelty-free as possible and not having any animal products in them as well. So Panacea is in Toronto, and it's the closest major intersection is...
It's at Bathurst and Bloor. I was going to give the address. It's actually at 588 Bloor Street West. If you get out at the Bathurst subway station, just walk west on Bloor for about a block and a half, and you will run smack into it.
And if you're outside of Toronto, it's worth the trip.
It is definitely worth the trip. So he's selling some clean canteens for some $5 off, soy milk is marked down. You can get some sweet, sweet deals on some sweet, sweet milk. And he also has the new So Delicious coconut milk ice cream, which I am a big fan of. And I'll probably be getting some today. Okay.
And if you're interested to learn more about Panacea, we did an interview with Ken, and that's archived on their website, animalvoices.ca, because Ken's really trying to use the store as a site of activism, too, and a way of doing vegan outreach. So it's definitely worth a listen, and Ken's very friendly. So if you want to go down there and chat with him about how you can be involved, I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
He would. The first news story today coming to us after those announcements from CBC News. The headline is PEI Environment Minister reminisces about blowing up beaver dams. Opposition questions on Thursday about a growing problem with beavers blocking PEI's waterways prompted reminiscences from Environment Minister Richard Brown of blowing up beaver dams. Brown told the legislature that his department is hiring people who hunt beavers to help clear the streams, then went on to recount how beavers were dealt with in his younger days. Quote, I had a few summers when I was a young fellow driving around Prince Edward Island with a couple of cases of dynamite in the car and blowing up dams, and I know the issues out there, he said. We had our ticket and we used to spend a couple of days a week going out and blowing up beaver dams. To which opposition leader Olive Crane responded, quote, you're the environment minister now? I wouldn't be telling people that. According to provincial officials, the hunters now being hired are professionals who remove the beavers in a humane manner. There's actually a couple more stories that that sprang up in response to that. If you want to check out those, you can check out cbc.ca. And the second and final story today coming to us from Washington Whispers. The headline is, Malia and Sasha Obama urged to join veggie campaign. The fight for veggie lunch options in public schools is landing on Capitol Hill, the White House, and Sidwell Friends School, where the Obama girls are students. Winter Grace Williams, the 14-year-old daughter of TV's Montel Williams, is coming to Washington to lobby Congress to amend the Child Nutrition Act to add veggie options and is sending a letter to Malia and Sasha Obama asking for their assistance. Quote, we want as much support as we can get on this, says Williams, an eighth grader at Central Middle School in Greenwich, Connecticut. In the letter to the Obamas, provided to Whispers, Winter Grace writes, quote, my name is Winter Grace and I'm a big fan of yours. It seems that we have a few things in common. We all love dogs, live on the East Coast, have fantastic moms and maternal grandmoms, and both of our dads are quite famous. In our household, we also eat healthy foods, and I am working on a school project to get healthier foods in schools across the country. I would love for you to join my campaign and sign my petition and encourage other students and families to follow our own and respective families' lead. Williams plans to join two Capitol Hill hearings Thursday and Friday with Neil Barnard of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine to lobby for the change. Williams says she also plans to speak at Sidwell Friends. In a statement, Barnard said, quote, President Obama's daughters attend a private school that offers healthy vegetarian options that all students should have access to, but most schools only provide meatless meals if Congress pushes them to do so. The White House had no comment. Williams told Whispers that she wants to leave a legacy in her school and public schools around the country of promoting veggie lunches. She argues that if schools provided a vegetarian option, more kids would choose it, thus cutting obesity. Also, she notes that some of her friends simply skip lunch because the options are usually fatty and loaded with sugars and salt. Winter Grace went veggie, she says, about 4 years ago, but she had never liked meat, much to her parents' dismay. Even at Thanksgiving, when her parents would urge her to eat traditional turkey, she'd balk, saying that turkeys shouldn't have to die to celebrate Thanksgiving. In its bid to improve the National School Lunch Program, the Physicians Committee is also producing a TV commercial featuring Williams. And that is the news for today.
Great. Thanks, Carl. I think we'll take a short musical break. We'll come back with Will, who is an award-winning investigative journalist, and we're going to be talking about the AETA, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which followed the Animal Enterprise Protection Act of 1992, I believe. So we're going to learn about what this means for animal and environmental activists. Certainly has had a huge impact on how people have been sentenced in the United States. So please stay tuned. We're going to talk with Will Potter coming up after the break. Hi, welcome back to the show. Today we're speaking with Will Potter, and he is a recognized and award-winning independent journalist, and he's based in Washington, D.C., and he's become a leading authority on eco-terrorism, and that's, of course, in quotes, the environmental and animal rights movements and civil liberties post-9/11. It's our great pleasure and honor to have Will Potter here with us today. Hi, Will.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
We're excited to talk to you. There's certainly a lot to cover. So let's start off hearing a little bit about your background and your interest in such things as the AETA.
My background is in mainstream newspapers and magazines. I used to work at the Dallas Morning News and the Chicago Tribune and the Chronicle of Higher Education, covering Congress here in D.C. And all that time, though, I was following, just as a personal interest, what was going on, this trend with labeling activists as domestic terrorists and eco-terrorists. Back in 99 or 2000, I wrote a story for the Texas Observer, which is an independent magazine out of Austin, about how this young woman was sent to no protesting for doing nonviolent civil disobedience. She'd been arrested a few times. As part of that, I mean, that's really how I started learning, even as far back as the late 90s, that these corporations were pushing the label activists as eco-terrorists. And then, of course, after September 11th, 2001, everything scaled up quite a bit.
Mm. And, of course, as a journalist, there's so many important stories and issues to cover. Why this, though, in particular, stands out as something that you wanted to focus your time on?
Well, because in many ways, it's a combination of two things I'm very passionate about. I mean, I care about environmental issues and animal protection issues. And also, I think civil liberties, especially post-9/11, are one of the most pressing domestic concerns right now. In terms of environmental issues and civil liberties issues, are really at the top of my priorities. They're always issues that have been particularly of interest to me, and now they're just, both of them are obviously coming to a head with the government trying to crack down on people that are defending the environment and labeling them as terrorists and trying to roll back people's basic rights.
Can you give us an overview then to the AETA? People might have heard of a former incarnation of this as the Animal Enterprises Protection Act, and of course it's morphed now into the AETA. Can you give us a sense of what the current act is about and some of its history and maybe also some of the highlights from the act?
Sure. Well, the AETA is the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It was passed in 2006. There were only six members of Congress in the room at the time when it passed the House. It passed by an obscure procedure that's used for non-controversial legislation, things like honoring baseball teams for winning the World Series, which is how it was used that week, and also used to pass new terrorism legislation that labels nonviolent civil disobedience, among other things, as terrorism if it's used against an animal enterprise. And that's pretty much what it sounds like. An animal enterprise is any business that has any ties to an animal industry. And what's really significant about this law, in my mind, are really two things. Not only is it expanding the definition of terrorism and wrapping up things like nonviolent civil disobedience and anything that, according to the law, targets corporate profits and property, but in addition to that, it's singling out a specific group of people, not because of the threat they pose to society at large or the threat to civilians. I mean, the animal rights movement, according to the FBI, has never harmed a single human being. So clearly they're not being singled out because they're the most pressing and most violent group domestically. They're being singled out because of their beliefs. And that's why these animal industries are the only ones protected under this legislation. And on top of that, though, the law does something really unique in terms of it expands the existing legislation and adds on this language that says it's not only terrorism if you target an animal enterprise. This law makes it terrorism if you target any company that's tangentially connected to an animal enterprise. They call it tertiary targeting. And that's kind of like what the anti-apartheid movement did. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with that social movement. And it wasn't just targeting, apartheid South Africa. It was targeting businesses that did business in apartheid South Africa. And that's really the model that a lot of animal rights activists have been following as well. I mean, rather than going out and saying, we're going to boycott animal researchers or this corporation that sells fur. Well, I think the animal rights movement has learned that these corporations really don't care if a small group of people boycott them. What they care about is threats to their profit. And so these activists that have been targeting any industry connected to those industries, and they've been quite successful. I think that's really, I know I'm giving kind of a long-winded explanation of the law, but there's a lot to say about it, because that's really what this is all about right now. The government is trying to single out a group of people that have been very effective, and they're doing that by trying to demonize them as terrorists to make everyday people afraid of using their rights.
One of the ironies, I think, of a lot of legislation for animal activists is that when we're trying to get the law to be mobilized in the interests of animals, it often isn't enforced. But when something like this comes along, we see the enforcement, obviously, people following through. And I was wondering if you could talk about the implications then and really why, as animal activists, people should be concerned about this. What have the impacts been of the AETA at this point?
Well, when I testified before Congress about this bill, when it was still a bill, and the concerns I raised were met very fiercely by both Democrats and Republicans on the committee, who said, "No, Mr. Potter, you're exaggerating all of this. This isn't going to be used against any First Amendment activity. We're just trying to go after people that are doing things like burning down laboratories and threatening researchers' lives and all this kind of talk." Well, after the law was passed, it sat there, and nobody used it for quite a bit, for almost 3 years. And then fast forward to just in the last few months, we've seen the law used for the first time in two different cases. The first is in California, with a group of activists that are not charged with threatening researchers or harming anyone or blowing up buildings or sending anthrax through the mail. They're charged in their indictment and in their criminal complaint. It lists activity including chalking slogans on public sidewalks, chalking defamatory slogans, like using children's chalk that's washable on public sidewalks. Also, it lists things like wearing bandanas at lawful protests. A lot of these activists wear bandanas now because the government's spying on them. They want to protest, and they want to speak up for what they believe in, but they don't want the government keeping spy files on them. So that's the kind of activity that's being prosecuted. There are four individuals charged under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act in California right now. And there's a second case in Utah of two individuals that are charged with releasing mink from fur farms. And although that's a little bit closer to how the law was actually pushed through Congress and what supporters said it would be used for, and it still doesn't fit anybody's idea of terrorism. I mean, these two people, at worst, allegedly released mink, not to harm anyone, and certainly not to harm the mink, but actually to protect life rather than to harm it, and that's what's being labeled as terrorism. So I think really the takeaway, not for just animal rights activists, but for anybody paying attention, is that this is a huge waste of government resources, and it's putting everybody else at risk. I mean, while we're targeting animal rights activists for war, we're taking nonviolent activity as terrorists. The people that are actually still plotting terrorist plots in the United States and elsewhere that aren't being prosecuted have their attention.
You've made the argument before that this is really part of what you see as a trajectory of focusing more and more on so-called radical groups and movements, sets of people. So the animal rights people, as you mentioned, don't end up being the only focus of something like this. It's really part of a larger process. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I think really what we've seen in the history of the United States, but also really in world history, when democracies start marching down this path of increased government power and demonizing groups of people as either communists, like in the Red Scare of the 40s and 50s in this country, is that it never stops there. What happens is dissidents are picked off, the so-called extremists or the radicals or some kind of a fringe group. And I think really two things take place. I call them wedges. I mean, the government tries to push a wedge between these so-called fringe groups and the wider population. You know, try to portray portray these animal rights activists as terrorists and that everyday people shouldn't be concerned about them because, you know, they're extremists. We don't need to worry about them. They're just, they're really bad people with radical views, and they think that you shouldn't even be able to go to the circus and you shouldn't be able to buy leather shoes and all that kind of talk. At the same time, what the government and these corporations are doing are trying to drive a wedge within the animal rights movement and environmental movement and trying to make the so-called more mainstream or welfarist or national organization distance themselves from anyone that's being labeled as an eco-terrorist or as a radical. So there's been pressure put on groups like the Humane Society and PETA and Sierra Club to say, you know, you have to come out and condemn groups, not only like the Animal Liberation Front, but Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty, or now even grassroots groups that are not doing anything extreme in their tactics, but have a more militant and purely animal rights philosophy. So the government's just trying to isolate these groups in every which way, and really once you do that, once you separate a group like that, it sets the precedent for targeting other social movements in the same way. And that's really what we've been seeing. I mean, in the 60s and the 60s and 70s in the United States, tactics that started with some social movements quickly spread to others, and they spread to include the Students for Democratic Society, the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Rights Movement, the American Indian Movement. I mean, these tactics were cross-applied to other groups. So it's kind of that old saying from Pastor Martin Niemöller from Nazi Germany, that, you know, first they come for the socialists or the communists, but they don't stop there. You know, if you don't speak up, they're going to be coming for you next. And that's not a cliche. I mean, it's been proven time again in world history.
Can you speak about the responses then by above ground and underground activists to the extent that we might know them? Because you just mentioned groups like the Humane Society of the United States, PETA, these other groups are sort of being, this is a warning about not associating with certain elements within movements, etc. What kind of response then have people had? Have people really then shied away from any kind of association with the Animal Liberation Front or what gets perceived as the more radical fringes of the animal rights movement? Has it had the effect that I think that these lawmakers were hoping for?
Well, I think we have to divide it into a couple areas. I mean, with the underground groups, I think it's resoundingly clear that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act does not stop groups like the Animal Liberation Front and related anonymous clandestine organizations. I mean, these crimes are still continuing. These individuals are still going out at night, taking action to either release free animals or to sabotage property. It's hard to get a feeling on specific numbers, but it's clear that these activities aren't going away. And if anything, we're seeing a lot of anonymous communiques from underground groups actually citing the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, in addition to other court cases that have been going on lately, and saying, all right, members of Congress, you know, U.S. government, you want to go after the above-ground groups? All it's going to do is put more people like us doing illegal things like this. And so if you want to target these people, we're going to kick up our activity in response. So they're directly commenting on the stupidity of legislation like this. The second group, though, I think we need to look at is like the above-ground groups that are strictly grassroots. I mean, they're not like national organizations. I think the response from them isn't as easy to decipher. It's clear that there is a lot of fear, and I think that's the entire intention of legislation like this, to instill fear, and it's to make people that aren't doing anything wrong afraid of using their rights. At the same time, though, I've talked to hundreds of activists around the country, and they're not turning away from their work. It's not something they're going to give up on. It's something they're so passionate about that they're willing, and they've committed themselves long ago to this cause and to these issues, and they're willing to sacrifice for it, even if it's putting themselves in some way at risk. Then the third group are the national organizations. And unfortunately, the response from them has been, I think, far less admirable. groups like the Humane Society have actually contributed money to these law enforcement eco-terrorist witch hunts. The Humane Society put up a few thousand dollars for any information relating to the arrest of this so-called animal rights terrorist in California who allegedly did property destruction. So the interesting point I just wanted to add on to that, with groups like the Humane Society coming out and condemning underground groups, it hasn't protected them. They've been targeted in full-page ads in the New York Times, labeling the Humane Society as a terrorist organization, even though they're spending money donating it to hunting down so-called animal rights terrorists.
Mm. And this is the Humane Society of the United States, HSUS?
HSUS.
Okay.
So it's clear, the rhetoric we hear from the government, these corporations, is keep your nose clean. If you do the right thing, you don't have anything to worry about, right? You know, if you're the good activist, if you're the good animal rights activist, you don't have anything to worry about. We're just worried about these bad guys. Like, that's how they talk about the war on terrorism in Iraq, Afghanistan, everywhere. You know, we're not hurting innocent people. We're just worried about the bad guys. But what we're seeing is they're trying to attack the entire animal rights movement. I mean, they're going after not just the Animal Liberation Front and calling them terrorists. They're calling the Humane Society a terrorist organization. Full-page ads, smear campaigns, public relations campaigns, media interviews. So clearly everyone is a target of this.
I think we're going to take a short break and come back. And I know Carl had some questions that he wanted to ask you about the context, sort of mapping a broader context for the rise of the AETA in the post-9/11 political climate. So we'll come back and talk a little bit about that. And we want to talk about the Red Scare as well, because you do have a blog, and I believe it's called Green is the New Red. So we'll talk about that too, and why you make the comparison between the environmental and the animal movements and what's happening to them, and the so-called Red Scare as well. So we'll come back with Will Potter on Animal Voices. Thanks.
Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're talking today with Will Potter. Will Potter is a decorated journalist. He has written extensively on the AETA, the Animal Enterprises Terrorism Act, as well as civil liberties issues, eco-terrorism, and all sorts of stuff like that. Will, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks again for having me.
I wanted to just ask if you could provide us with a little bit of context about the AETA. When I heard about the AETA first coming into being, it was certainly around the time that there was tons of debate happening in the U.S. about the Patriot Act and other sort of similar pieces of legislation. I was wondering if you could maybe give us a little bit of an overview. There's a few questions I wanted to throw out there. More or less wondering about what were the sort of political factors that led to the formation of the AETA, why it would require to be made instead of just relying on the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and do you have a sense of how potentially animal industries were involved in lobbying for the creation of or being directly involved in the formation of the AETA?
Sure. Well, I guess the best way to start would be to talk about the previous law you mentioned. It's called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. That was a law first passed in 1992, and similar to this new one, it really didn't get a lot of attention when it was passed. It was lobbied by pharmaceutical and cattle and fur industries, all these animal industries that wanted specific terrorism legislation targeting animal rights activists. And they got it. I mean, the law was called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, but it did create the crime of, quote, animal enterprise terrorism. But despite that victory for these corporate lobbyists, the law sat on the shelf for a number of years. And in fact, it was only really used twice. Once in the case of Justin Samuel and Peter Young, two activists that were arrested for releasing mink from fur farms in the western United States. And all told, you know, they've gotten no more than 2 years in prison each for that. And the second use was a few years later of a group called Stop Hunting and Animal Cruelty. and they were not charged with releasing animals or destroying property. They were charged with conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Protection Act by running a very controversial website that merely supported and endorsed a wide range of tactics in the campaign to close a lab called Huntington Life Sciences. And they did things like posting anonymous communiques that they received or that they saw on other websites. They did things like advertise lawful protests and post recaps of lawful protests submitted by activists. And they also did things like if they received an anonymous communique that had information about where an executive lived or his home phone number or something like that, they had a policy to post all that on the website. So they were convicted of conspiracy, sentenced between 1 and 6 years in prison. So, the law was, the limits were pushed of that law with the existing legislation. And I say that because, when this new version of the law came around, these industries were pushing for even more. When I testified before Congress, the law had already been used to not only target property destruction, but to target people that were simply using their First Amendment rights to talk about a wide range of tactics and run a controversial yet effective campaign. The industry groups, though, testified before Congress and the Department of Justice said with a straight face that they needed more power, that the existing laws were not effective, that the government needed more power, more authority, more wiretap, phone tapping authority, more email surveillance authority to go after these underground groups, that existing laws weren't enough to crack down on them. In other words, they completely lied, flat out lied to Congress about how the existing law was being used. And as a result, you had these significant expansions to the law take place. So we took a law that was already vague, already overly broad, already a constitutional threat, in my opinion, of labeling nonviolent activists and First Amendment activity as terrorism, and then these industry groups expanded it. And you had mentioned and asked about the lobbying that went on to get this passed. I've researched quite a bit. There's still, some holes, and you don't know all the backdoor dealings that went on. But a few things are very clear. One of them is I got access to the internal website of a group called the Animal Enterprise Protection Coalition. And shortly after I did, and I published all their internal documents, they took the website down. But all those documents are now on greenisthenewred.com. And they show all the corporations and industries that supported this law, like Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, Wyeth, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the Fur Commission, you name it, this laundry list of animal corporations. And in addition to that, in their own documents, they list every member of Congress and whether or not that member of Congress supports the legislation, opposes it, or remains neutral or hasn't weighed in yet. So according to their own paperwork and their own lobbying documents, they only had the support of literally a handful of members of Congress. So what that means is they knew they didn't have the vote. Mm-hmm. Yet these corporations lobbied so heavily behind the scenes that they were able to rush the law through with only 6 members of Congress in the room in the House, and then in the middle of the night in the Senate by unanimous consent. And that's how they were able to get it passed. It was clearly a case of protecting corporate interests.
It's interesting because I'm kind of reminded of the potency of that word terrorist, and the way that now the legislation includes the word terrorist, and you mentioned about how these corporations wanted further and further protection, not only from the illegal activities, sort of ALF style, burning down buildings and threatening researchers and that type of thing, to things like posting information on websites or in the way that the law has been applied, going after people who have used chalk to write slogans on sidewalks. Maybe this seems like a strange question, but in your opinion, why should the activities that are outlawed under the ATEA AETA be allowed? If people are thinking of sort of being the good activist versus being the bad activist, why shouldn't things like home protests or sending black faxes or blogging about animal enterprise CEOs, why shouldn't those things be illegal in your opinion?
Well, to be clear, I'm not arguing that all those things aren't illegal. I mean, I think certainly something like chalking is getting to absurd levels that I would question and defend that as being legal activity. But I think really the bottom line is whether or not it's terrorism. With all of these things that we're seeing that the corporations and government are trying to crack down on in the animal rights movement, things like releasing animals from fur farms or breaking a window at a McDonald's or throwing red paint on a fur store, those are all illegal acts. And I don't question whether or not they're legal or illegal. I mean, it's pretty clear that they're not. But it's also, in my mind, pretty clear that it's not anywhere approaching a reasonable person's idea of terrorism. And so when you take existing crimes and you single them out and try to apply these enhanced penalties and apply this word terrorism simply because of the politics of someone, of the person that did the crime, I think that's what should make everyone stop and really be concerned. Because it's going down a dangerous path. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, these animal rights activists have no right to release animals from fur farms, and that law enforcement should be prosecuting it, arresting those people, hitting them with theft or trespassing, whatever the penalties that apply. It's quite another to be singling them out and say, we're going to treat you on the same level of people flying planes and buildings. We're going to label you a terrorist, a label that's going to follow you not only through the criminal justice system, it's going to follow you once you go to prison and affect your how you were incarcerated. It's going to affect once you're released from prison and being labeled a terrorist the rest of your life, all because of your political beliefs. And I think that really is the most dangerous element of this, of recklessly using that word in order to smear someone just because of their political beliefs.
I wanted to ask you about more of a historical overview. As I mentioned before we went to the break, and you touched on too, you have a blog called GreenIsTheNewRed.com, and of course this is a comparison to the Red Scare, and your work is often associated with talking about the so-called Green Scare, which we're sort of talking around. And I was wondering if you can give us that overview, because I think that your insights into social movements and the way that civil disobedience and violence in its various incarnations has been used is really insightful and gives us more of a sense that these issues don't kind of come out of nowhere and they're not emerging in a historical vacuum. So can you provide that overview, that more historical overview for us?
Well, I think you made the point better than I could have. I mean, that's absolutely what I'm saying. It's just trying to make sure that we're not looking at any of this in a historical vacuum. I mean, with using that analogy, with the Red Scare and the Green Scare, it's not to say in any way that what's going on right now is exactly the same as what happened during the Red Scare of labeling people as communists and having the House Un-American Activities Committee and things like that. And it's also not to say that it's any worse or any better or any different. It's simply to identify a period in U.S. history that most high school students can identify as a terrible mistake, that it was the path that this country went down that is really a black mark on the history of this country and persecuting people because of their beliefs. And I think there's something to learn from that in the sense that, well, to put it another way, I initially started using that comparison just for those reasons, because I thought it was an interesting way to make people think about these issues and to draw a comparison the most notable era of government repression in U.S. history. But the more you look at it, really the comparisons are quite eerie. The way that the Red Scare worked is by using one word, the word communist, so relentlessly and so virulently that it scared people out of using their basic rights. And it also used that word in courts, in legislation, and in public relations campaigns to ruin people's lives in all believe that there really was a communist threat to national security. But the real reason was that of the politics and the ideology of the people that were being labeled as communists. And that's exactly, I mean, exactly what's going on right now. I'm using this word terrorist and terrorism to demonize a group of people, to single them out because of their political beliefs through the courts, through legislation, and through public relations and media campaigns. So when we make those comparisons, I think it's really easy to be overwhelmed by it. I mean, I certainly don't want people to see comparisons like that and think, well, so this is just inevitable. I mean, governments have done this throughout history. They did it during the Red Scare. They're doing it now. They'll probably do it another however many years from now with a different group of people. You know, in some ways, a case can be made for that. I mean, the people in power tend to abuse their power and to try to go after their opposition. But at the same time, I think, you know, we can be empowered by it as well and recognize that we don't have to let history repeat itself. We can learn from these mistakes. We don't have to wait 20, 30 years before we can recognize that that type of government repression was wrong. I mean, we can step in early, stop it from happening, and really learn from this history and stop it from repeating itself.
Well, you were mentioning in your previous response, you were talking about the way that this sort of stigmatization is not only working on the outside for people who are, you know, haven't necessarily been prosecuted. But I know you were also on Democracy Now! Recently, and you were talking about special U.S. prisons, and some of these prisons actually have people who have been either prosecuted under the AEPA or the AETA in them. And is that sort of stigmatization and the... Do you have a sense if that stigmatization and that labeling as an animal enterprise terrorist, do you have a sense of how that is potentially affecting the way people are treated once they have been prosecuted?
I've interviewed both current and former prisoners from the animal rights and environmental movement, and it's clearly having a very significant impact in a wide variety of ways. I mean, during sentencing, as early as the sentencing process, that label comes into play because, particularly with the environmental activists, they've been hit with these terrorism enhancement penalties. And what that does, in many cases, it hasn't actually increased the length of their prison time, but it officially applies this terrorist label to their case. And therefore, once they enter the prison system, and they have the Bureau of Prisons assign their designation, whether it's a low, medium, or high security facility, that goes into play. And that's a dangerous thing when we think about a lot of these people, and even most of these people, all of them have no history of violence. And at worst, they have some history of property destruction. But with these animal rights activists, some of them don't even have that. And they're being put in prison, in some cases, with violent offenders, with people that have been convicted for terrorism, real terrorism-related crimes. So that's, I think, in my mind, the biggest impact right off the bat. Also, we've seen that once people are in prison, the Bureau of Prisons does things like transport them in what are called black boxes. You might have seen in that terrible movie Con Air with Nick Cage a while back, but they had, you know, these black boxes over inmates' hands, and they're for the most violent, dangerous criminals. And you have these, you know, young vegan activists wearing black boxes as they're being transported to keep them from harming guards, is what they say, because they're a terrorist. You also have them wearing these bright orange or red, it depends on the facility, these bright jumpsuits that single them out as a high security risk and an extremist and a violent offender, even though they've never done anything like that. And now, the facilities you mentioned have just come to light, or I should say more details are coming to light every week. They're called communication management units. And what I found out is that there looks like at least two of them in the country, maybe more. They were created, they violated government protocol in their creation. They severely restrict prisoner communication with the outside world. They radically limit their phone calls and their letters. They try to cut them off from their family and friends and from the general population of prisoners and also the general population of U.S. society and get them out of sight and out of mind. And there's one environmental activist that I know of in there right now at the facility in Marion, activist Daniel McGowan. You can find more information about him on my website as well. And another activist, an animal rights activist, Andy Stepanian, one of the Shack activists, was released from that communications management unit. And he's actually the first person in U.S. history to be released from that facility, from one of these secretive facilities. Hmm. So the government has been intentionally tight-lipped about who's in these facilities and why. The activists are not given any opportunity to challenge their designation. They are simply transferred there without notice. Their family and friends and even attorneys really don't know what's going on and why they were put there. And on top of that, they're given no means of challenging and getting out of that facility. And the government Freedom of Information Act request for public records has actually refused to release the full list of names of who are in these facilities. In essence, they're creating secretive facilities, secretive prisons on U.S. soil.
I wanted to, we're just down to the last 8 minutes, and I really want to play the devil's advocate to the extent that I can.
Sure.
And to give a bit of a summary, because I know that we've touched on a lot of issues. So I'm just going to play the devil's advocate here. I'm imagining some animal activists, maybe this is just the imaginary animal activists, there really aren't people out there like this, but saying, I don't really see how the AETA stuff affects me. This is, you know, these are sad stories about these activists who are maybe getting heaped with this label that isn't quite fair, but they did engage in some illegal activities. You kind of get, you knew you were going to go to jail anyway. I don't really see how this affects my activism as somebody who hands out pamphlets and, you know, I've been divided on whether or not I think violence or illegal activities are worthwhile anyway, so why should I care about this at all?
Well, and I think that's really the biggest and most successful myth that corporations and the government has pushed related to all this, is that if you just do the right kind of activism, you don't have anything to worry about. And that these people are all really the evil bad guys who have done terrible things that you would never be a part of, so just forget about them and go about your business. In reality, what we're seeing is that, one, these people aren't unlike everybody else. I mean, at worst, some of them have engaged in property destruction, but not all of them. With the Shack activists, I mean, they ran a controversial website. A couple of their defendants weren't even involved in that. Their part of the conspiracy was only sending around an email advertising a protest and advertising this tactic of black facts, which is just sending faxes to this corporation. And in addition to that, you have these activists out in California. They certainly didn't know what they were getting into, being labeled a terrorist for chalking slogans and for distributing flyers. So I think, although I can see how people can come to that conclusion, because these activists have been so demonized in the press, and there's been so much misinformation about these cases. The reality is, these kind of attacks put everyone at risk. I mean, if they can go after the Humane Society, nobody is going to be safe from this terrorism rhetoric. And that's not to say everyone should just kind of hole up in their house and, you know, play Xbox and, you know, watch, just forget about activism and not do anything political anymore because you're going to be labeled a terrorist. It means you need to come out loud and clear and say, no, we're not going to allow any of this to be labeled as terrorism. We're going to stand by these prisoners and also continue doing our work and fighting back against this kind of reckless use of the word terrorist.
We only have a few more minutes left, and I just want to turn it over to you if there's sort of the takeaway message, things that you want people to know. You can certainly plug your blog and what you'd like people to know about the AETA and maybe a bit more about how people can stand in solidarity with these people who have been imprisoned and are being affected by the AETA.
Well, I think really the takeaway message of all this for me is not to succumb to the fear, because that's, you know, the intention of all this. And I know having a program where we're talking about all these issues for your listeners, it can be overwhelming. I mean, we're dumping a lot of information about terrorist legislation and these secretive prisons, and it can be quite scary and daunting to think about. But at the same time, I think we need to remember that the animal rights environmental movement is in very good company, that people throughout U.S. history that have been targeted by similar tactics, such as the civil rights movement, the American Indian movement, the anti-war movement, Students for Democratic Society, Martin Luther King, are all people that we revere now as heroes. They have holidays named after them, and that they were on the right side of history. And I don't think we should let that make us egotistical in any way of thinking, oh, you know, we're doing the right thing, anything we do is excusable, and, you know, we're going to have holidays named after us. But I do think we need to remember that, like...
But can't we?
Can't we, please? we're in really good company. And I think, you know, we can't overstate that Martin Luther King had thousands and thousands of pages of FBI files and surveillance on him. Not to say that Martin Luther King is the same as all these environmental and animal rights activists, but, I mean, the government does have a history of going after people that are doing the right thing. I think we just need to take stock of that and remember it every time the fear starts to creep in. And most importantly, you know, go to greenisthenewred.com. There's listings of all the prisoners' websites, and write them letters and donate to their support committees. And also, there's plenty of resources on the website to educate yourself and to email it to other people, to put it on your Facebook page. I mean, simple things like that take 2 seconds that can raise awareness.
I wanted to point quickly too before we end the program, because I think that it's easy sometimes when we're doing a show like this for it to just sound like, you know, you're just critiquing the government. It can start sounding like conspiracy theories. They're out to get the activists. But
right.
I just want to highlight and maybe get you to point a little bit to the underlying capitalist corporate interests that really help drive these kinds of legislation and allow them to flourish in this kind of political climate.
Well, and I think that's a really, really, really important point to make, that this isn't a conspiracy theory. I mean, there's no black helicopter kind of New World Order thing we're talking about. I mean, they're very blunt. I think the corporations and these politicians, are exceedingly blunt about what they're doing and how they're doing it. They're not hiding the fact that this is about protecting their profit. It says so in the legislation. And they're not hiding the fact that they're using their political prowess to influence the legislation. I mean, we heard about it in the congressional hearing. It's on my website in the transcript. The secretive prisons have all been confirmed by the government in their own documents. But I think it's bigger than that in some ways, because it's not only a threat to business as usual and capitalism, but it's also a cultural war, I think, that they're fighting right now. The Red Scare, I think, was about protecting corporate profits and about protecting capitalist interests, but it was also about protecting this kind of abstract American way of life that, of course, included capitalism and Christianity and empire. And now they're really trying to do the same thing, and they view these environmental and animal rights activists as attacking what it means to be an American and what it means to be a human being, in addition, the most wealthy and powerful nation on the planet.
We're out of time. Will, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you guys for having me. It's great talking to you.
I want to direct people again to your website, greenisthenewred.com, and people can learn more about how they can get involved there. And Carl, I should say thanks for organizing this program too.
Not a problem. And thanks, Will, from myself for being on the program as well.
We'd love to talk to you again.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, great.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks. Bye. You've been listening to Animal Voices. We were just speaking with Will Potter, who is an award-winning independent journalist. You can go to his website, greenisthenewred.com, find out more about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and how it affects you and the people that are doing work for animals and the environment. Please stay tuned for Dos Mundos coming up. It's going to be a good show.